Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. When energy companies build well sites in the boreal forest, the forest just doesn't come back. Ecologist Dr. Terry Osko is researching better techniques to reclaim those well sites. And an oral history assignment in Hendrika Bolio's Native Studies class has turned into a cross-border monolith with the Blackfoot Confederacy. And there's new help for tax time frenzy. Intuit Canada offers up Snap Tax, guaranteed to help you finish the dreaded job in 15 minutes or less. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Pipelines, seismic lines, and well sites take a big chunk out of the boreal forest. Reducing seismic lines from 8 meters wide to less than 2 has been a significant improvement. But when it comes to reclaiming patches where well pads are located, that's another story. Once the topsoil is removed, it's a real struggle for trees to grow back. Dr. Terry Osko is a forest ecologist working on a research project aimed at improving reclamation technology.
Well, the problem historically is well sites in the boreal forest are different than well sites more in the agricultural land. However, historically they've been treated the same in terms of their construction and reclamation. So what has happened is that sites that were built, constructed even 30 years ago, can still remain in a grass-like state today versus a forest, which is what everyone hopes they would come back to be. Not all of the sites end up being grass forever. Trees do grow back on them, but they tend to be smaller in stature than what you'd expect from after a forest fire or after timber harvest.
So essentially it's removing the forest from the forest.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like I liken it to taking a little patch of your lawn every year and spraying it with Roundup. And eventually when you spray enough patches, you don't have a lawn anymore.
How are well sites normally constructed?
Today, they're constructed in a variety of different ways. Historically, basically the main concern for the well site is that a level, stable surface is required for the drilling rig. So normally, what has been done in the past is that the topsoil is stripped, and then the subsoil is used to leveled and used to make a level base for the drilling rig. And then once the drilling is completed, depending on whether or not the well remains in production, if it's a dry hole or sometimes it's just drilled for exploratory purposes, then it might be abandoned right away. So then the site is recontoured and the topsoil is replaced. There's well site criteria that's required to be followed that Alberta Environment publishes, and the criteria has evolved over time. About 20 years ago or so, there wasn't any criteria for salvaging topsoil in the boreal forest, so basically the topsoil was moved aside, the drilling was completed, and then the well was left to recover on its own. And more recently, there has been more criteria for topsoil replacement. The latest criteria that's available right now is from 1995, and in those criteria, the topsoil replacement requirement isn't as stringent in the forest as it is on agricultural land.
Why is it that it doesn't come back?
Well, it could be a number of reasons. When the topsoil is removed, obviously all the organic matter, all the living organisms in the soil aren't available there for the trees to use. When the topsoil is cleared, it also removes all the roots that were in the soil and the seed bank, so that's not available to produce new trees. Another problem is these sites, in order to control erosion, which is a good thing, is that they've been planted to grass, and the grass competes heavily with the trees. So there's a number of different ways that sort of barriers are put up for the trees to come back in.
What impact does that have on the forest ecosystem?
Well, I guess obviously as these sites accumulate, a number of things. One is that a mathematical calculation gives, just like the example that I made of with the lawn and spraying Roundup on it, is that over time the total amount of forest is being reduced. But in the meantime, you have a bunch of little patches that are not forest, and it fragments the forest. So, you know, creatures that require uniform or continuous forest are continually running into areas where that isn't the case anymore.
You have a project now that is looking at how you can come up with better ways of reclaiming these well sites. What are you looking at?
Well, we're looking at a number of things. So I guess we're trying to answer four basic questions. And the first question is, what are the factors that are causing these sites to be poor producers of forest? So are there factors that are impairing productivity? The second question is, how long do those factors remain, or how long do they persist? And then the two final questions, the first is, can these factors be avoided during the construction phase? So can we build well sites in such a manner that we avoid these site impairment factors? And then the final question is, well, if we can't do that during construction, then what can we do during reclamation to ensure that these sites come back to a forest in the quickest manner possible?
So you've got your experimental project set up in northeastern Alberta. What kinds of things have you been trying out, and what are you finding from them?
Right now we're concentrating on sites that have been constructed in winter, and we're comparing two methods of construction, one in which the topsoil is stripped in order to build the well pad, as I had described earlier, and another method where the topsoil is left undisturbed, where the well pad is constructed by using snow and ice, as well as the woody debris on the site, to build a flat surface that will support the rig.
Well, how big do these well sites have to be?
About a half a hectare. They're 70 meters by 70 meters, so that's 0.49 hectares.
That's an awful lot of area.
Yes, it's quite large. Older sites, and depending on the depth of the hole that they're drilling, will require a larger area. And so the EUB has minimum site requirements, and a lot of those are based on a safety and just room to move. So depending on what kind of facilities are required on the well site itself will dictate the size.
Do you have any results yet from the work that you've been doing?
Yes, we have some results. What we have been finding is that well sites that are constructed with the soil stripped seem to come back slower in terms of natural regeneration or natural regrowth than sites that don't have the topsoil stripped. However, there's a complicating factor, and that is the woody debris that's left over. So this is a forested site. The timber is salvaged from the site before the well site is constructed, but there still remains woody debris in terms of slash, limbs, and tops of the trees. In some cases, that material is mulched. In other cases, it's left whole. But in either case, if there's too much of it, then it insulates the soil and interferes with natural regrowth.
Well, why is that? Is it too hot?
No. Well, when the mulch is too deep on the soil, then it's slow in heating up in the springtime, so it remains cold or even frozen longer. And then in the summer, the peak temperature isn't as warm as soil that is exposed, or even the forest floor, an intact forest floor that's exposed.
What other things are you going to try?
We're interested in looking at summer construction methods where topsoil stripping is going to be a lot more difficult to avoid, because you can't freeze the debris in on top to build a well pad. So we want to look at what kind of silvicultural opportunities there are in terms of treating the site with equipment to produce sites that are most conducive to growing trees, as well as comparing tree species and shrub species to see what works best in a variety of conditions.
What do you see as some of the challenges ahead?
I think some of the challenges are revolve around getting everyone up to the same speed. I think there's a lot of energy companies out there that are very responsible and are leading the way in terms of the technology in site construction and, I guess, reclamation and remediation. And I think it has part of the issue has to do with the present well site reclamation criteria is that there's a lot of room for inconsistency in terms of how the criteria are applied. So there's a lot of operators that go far beyond what the criteria dictate, whereas other operators might do less. So you have a wide range of how the sites are treated and how they are recovering. So our goal here is to demonstrate what works now, what people are doing now, and from the, you know, what is working now, what's working good now, identifying that, looking at some things that could be improved, and trying to bring everyone up to the same level.
What would be the ideal in terms of reclamation of these well sites?
Well, ideally, the less the site is disturbed to begin with, the less you have to worry about the recovery of the forest after the fact. So ideally, if we could develop technology that either eliminates the need to disturb the surface, if we do that, we'd be miles ahead.
How much longer do you have to go?
Well, the project's scheduled for 5 years, so we're into our third year right now. We're hoping to produce a manual of best practices and have that published in early 2008. There might be some need for further monitoring beyond that time, but we'd like to get at least a bulk, you know, of the work done by 2008.
Thank you very much, Terry.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Terry Osco, a forest ecologist with Osco Natural Resources Consulting. The University of Lethbridge sits in the heart of Blackfoot Country and has recently embarked on an ambitious history project which involves the people of the Blackfoot Confederacy on both sides of the 49th parallel. Hendrika Bolio is an adjunct assistant professor in Native American Studies at the University of Lethbridge, and she's the director of the Community University Research Alliance, or as it's called in the native tongue, Atano-Pinan-Natosi, moving towards the sun.
Oh, the Blackfoot Confederacy is huge, and actually they're restricted now because of legal processes through the treaty years to a far smaller section of the area that they originally controlled pre-treaty. Actually, the Lame Bull Treaty ceremonies for the 150 years is next year, and it's one of the things that we're working on with Montana. But at that time, the Lame Bull Treaty stipulated that Blackfoot Confederacy land started at Yellowstone National Park and moved up somewhere to the area once you kind of moved across the border to Red Deer. And of course, they're constricted to a relatively smaller section of sections of land now. But the Confederacy is a very vital group of nations, actually, that have a tremendous amount of history and knowledge to offer with respect to both their past and their present and the future that they're working towards. They're a very interesting partner in terms of this particular alliance.
How many people?
We're working specifically with two members. We're working with Southern Bogunni, which is the Blackfeet Nation of Montana. And I believe that if I'm looking at my demographics properly, there's probably around 15,000 in the Browning area. And then we're working with the Blood or the Gunnawah Nation, which is across the border. And I think 13,000 on reserve for the Gunnawah peoples. But the people that are direct participants in this project are represented by Blood and Southern Bogunni, so that would be about 28,000.
Have they maintained a fair bit of their culture?
A number of the Confederacy groups really have, and there's also a strong resurgence. So, for example, this is really noticeable among the Gunnawah, among the Blood, who have a continuous line of tradition that wasn't broken over the years and that is now resurging in a very big way in terms of the younger generation's incorporation into that tradition. And that may have something to do, for example, with and one of the things that I think that we'll be discussing, I hope on a research basis with some of the partners. But it's noticeable that there is a real divergence between the retention of traditional culture on this side of the border and what was stamped out across the 49th parallel. So that, for example, the Blackfoot language is far stronger amongst the Blood than it is among the Blackfeet in Montana.
What is the genesis of this project?
My oral history class. I taught oral history for a number of years in anthropology here at the University of Lethbridge, and it's a passion. But one of the things that happened during a semester is that in my focus on getting kids to actually do oral history after they were given the practical tools, is that within a semester time limit, they usually ended up having to interview either family members or close friends, and they went back, of course, to elderly people. So I had this emerging phenomenon where I was getting this wonderful settler memories record in southern Alberta and Saskatchewan, because we have a lot of Saskatchewan students here, as well as elders that were being interviewed by First Nations students. And this was really remarkable because I was getting early farmers and early settlers and ranchers from this area, and then also elders' memories from the First Nations. And I just became really excited about the idea of incorporating, or at least doing, because it hasn't been done for the Confederacy, a whole oral history project that would try to record memories of the elders before they passed on.
Now that you do have your funding in place, what does this project encompass?
Right from the beginning, we had four components because of the Shirkman criteria for the Kahara. So besides the oral history section of the project, we had archaeology, which we believed were the stories the land could tell us in relation to the stories we would also get from people. We had a history archival section because we wanted to challenge the standard academic histories that have been written about this area with the oral history, that juxtaposition process I was talking about that had started to occur in my classroom. And we have an education component by virtue of the fact that education has become a huge issue for First Nations, and the way in which it's incorporated or the way knowledge is transferred in the Western system looks different than the way in which knowledge was transferred traditionally from elders to youngers within the Confederacy, and looking at the ways perhaps in which those conflicting educational models might impact Aboriginal youth in this area. We've been very slow to structure because it's the intellectual property issues that are most keenly felt in the oral history section.
Why would intellectual property be an issue?
It's an issue for First Nations in relation to their culture and their feelings with respect to what cultural artifacts belong with First Nations and over which they have some control. And that's been particularly an issue in the anthropological areas because there certainly is a feeling among First Nations in Canada that there's been some rape of culture in relation to anthropological investigations, particularly early on, and that there's also been knowledge communicated by white scholars that actually belonged to particular societies, that belonged not even to the First Nations group as a whole, and so that there has been a general disregard for the cultural context in which that information was given and the trust relationships that were or were not built between the people collecting the information and the people that were giving the information. So IP is an issue, and it's particularly an issue when it comes into play in oral history investigations.
Thank you very much, Henry.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Hendrika Beaulieu, director of the Community University Research Alliance with the Blackfoot Confederacy at the University of Lethbridge. There's just a few more weeks left to get your taxes done. If you're dreading the thought of sitting down and filling out the forms, well, you're not alone. And on the other hand, if you're one of those people who still does your taxes by hand, then you're not alone either. And that makes you a prime marketing target for some new software from Intuit Canada, the people who make QuickTax. One of the first brainwaves to come out of the new Intuit Center for Innovation in College Plaza is a new product called SnapTax. Gordon Meeberg is the project manager for SnapTax.
Well, SnapTax is this great new innovation in the tax field. And, you know, obviously we have a great product called QuickTax today that serves our customers very well, but there's still a lot of people that don't use tax software, and we wanted to understand why. There's a lot of people that still, every year, almost 6 million of them use pen and paper to file their tax return. And so by going out and talking to these customers, by understanding their tax situation, their behaviors, we really felt that there was a need to come up with a product that was very simple, very clean, very easy to use, and address the need of the majority of people that just had very basic situations like a T4, some investments, maybe an RSP deduction, some child care tuition fees, and just those very basic situations that we could do and get them through it in less than 15 minutes. Start to finish, do your tax return in 15 minutes. That was our design objective, and that's what we worked hard to achieve.
Who came up with the name Snap?
It really felt like the right name for the product because it was, you know, doing your taxes as a snap. We all have QuickTax, but this felt like, you know, even faster than Quick. This is a snap your fingers and your taxes are done.
Well, I like that idea. And you've got it fired up on the computer here right now. And we've gone through a return once. And one of the things that I really noticed is there's actually a lot of stuff missing from there, which makes it really neat. What have you taken out? What have you left in?
Well, some of the things we've taken out, we've gone through very diligently, and we went line by line through the actual tax return, and every single line we agonized over it. Is this something that's important to the majority of people, or is this something that addresses just a very small percentage of people? So some of the things we have taken out, like, are all forms of small business income, because those are typically more complex scenarios and really it's not something that you can do in 15 minutes. So we've taken out the small business, the self-employed, a lot of the, you know, for integration of farming and fishing income. And we looked at extensively at data both internally as well as provided by the CRA in terms of statistic on each type of deduction, each type of income source, what percentage of Canadians had that. And if it didn't meet our criteria of, you know, at least 5 to 10% of Canadians having this one, it wasn't something that we looked at.
Well, the other thing that a lot of thought has gone into has been the layout of it. You've got certain colors, certain layouts. What's the thinking behind the beige and the blue?
Well, it's very interesting because when we went into it, there was a number of different screen layouts that we tried, and we started with the idea that because this is a product that's targeted at the pen and paper user, they're going to be familiar with the tax form. So we wanted something that was form-based. Our first iteration looked very much like the tax form, and we realized, well, that's okay, but we can add a lot more value here. And we started working with that form, making it simpler, thinking of ways to improve it. And some of the things we did was we looked at even things like colors, tried different colors, starting with blue. People are familiar with tax form blue. And when we tried different color schemes, we found that actually using a beige color on the screen, the reaction we got from customers told us that they found the color more comforting, they felt more confident using the product with that color, and they felt more confident in the results.
For people who are used to doing their taxes by pen and paper, what would entice them to use this, to do this on the computer? What do they need?
Well, you know, speed was a big thing, and often people don't like doing their taxes. We heard that over and over again. Nobody told us, wow, I just love and I look forward to doing my taxes. They told us, you know, it's something I know I have to do, but I don't enjoy doing it. So we wanted to make it just very easy for them and very comforting for them to do their taxes. But another thing that we found as well was there was a perception that they wanted to understand how the calculations were done. They wanted to see what was happening. And a lot of tax software products today, the tax part of it is like a black box where the customer has some questions or interview things that they answer, but they don't see how the calculations are being done or what's happening behind the scenes. And so what we've done with SnapTax is we've tried to open up that black box just a little bit and show you what's happening. As you go through the form, when you enter in numbers, you see numbers changing on your screen and they're slowed down so you can see the changes and watch it happening.
This is web-based, and when you get to the point where you've gone through everything and the little happy face comes up and it says, yes, you've done it right, you're ready to send it off if you want, how do you know that all your information isn't going to end up in somebody else's hands?
Well, that's a very good question, and one of the things that we found out when we talked to people who do pen and paper, when we asked them about their perception of web product, there was some concern they expressed about entering their tax information on a website. And so when we did our design on the product, that was one of our design considerations, and we made a very clear, conscious effort not to save your tax information on our web server. So when you actually save your information, the only place it is ever saved is on your computer hard drive. We never save any tax information of the consumer on our web servers. So the consumer is completely in control of their tax data at all times.
You've got a project going now with some students at the University of Alberta with this. What's that all about?
Well, it's an exciting project that we kicked off. And as we were looking at the product and brainstorming different ways to create promotional energy around it, one of the ideas we came up with was this is a product that targeted with students. Why don't we get some students to market it? And sort of serendipitously, I was at a social event and bumped into a former colleague who happened to be a sessional lecturer at the U of A. And we got to chatting, and it turned out she was doing a fourth-year marketing course. And I had this great idea for a project, and we started talking about it. And it sort of fell into place from there. So we do have a fourth-year marketing communications class at the U of A. Has divided their class into 8 groups, and each of the group has the task of coming up with an integrated marketing plan for SnapTax. Once they've developed the plan and presented to us and we approve their plan, each of the groups is given $500 to actually go out and execute the plan and run their promotion. Each group is given a unique URL that they design, so www.snaptax.ca/whatever extension they want to use. And we're able then to give them instant feedback through a tracking website that we built where they can go in and see for each of their URLs how many hits they've generated, how many started returns, and how many completed returns, and so what the return on their marketing investment is, which is a great opportunity because very rarely in a university class do students get the opportunity to actually work on a real-world project, and not only that, but to not only come up with a plan, but to actually implement the plan as well and see the results in real time.
For people who are interested in trying out SnapTax, what's the information they need to get onto the web?
Well, all they need to do is go to the URL, www.snaptax.ca, and it'll come up with a homepage, and all the information is available there, how to get started and go through your tax return.
Thank you very much, Gordon.
Thank you.
That was Gordon Meeberg, Project Manager for SnapTax at Intuit Canada. You can play with SnapTax for free, and if you do decide to use it, the cost is a low $9.95. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.